presents First Years, a podcast for all but geared toward adult first-time readers of Harry Potter, who need a space to enjoy each book and have adult conversations about it. My name is Sarah, and I'm honored that you've allowed me on this journey with you. Crack open a butterbeer, grab a seat, and let's discuss. Today, we're talking about Chamber of Secrets, the movie. Welcome to episode 13 of First Years. Today we are going over the movie adaptation of Chamber of Secrets. But before we get into that, we have some special House Points news, as I promised everybody there would be. So thank you everybody who participated in our House Cup Cocktails event. I had so much fun and I hope that you guys did too. So as promised, we have the winner of the House Cup. So in third place are tied Gryffindor and Ravenclaw with 70 points each. In second place, we have Slytherin with 200 points. And in first place, and I am not surprised myself, and I don't think anybody else should be, with 250 points is Hufflepuff. So all of the members of Hufflepuff House will be entered into a giveaway, and I will be contacting that person via Instagram. And I will be giving away a house edition of whichever Harry Potter book you would like. So congratulations to all the Hufflepuffs. I will be in contact if you are the winner, and I am super excited for all of you. So now that we have a House Cup winner, everything from here on out is going to be a clean slate. We're going to start over with House Points. So as a reminder, ways to earn House Points, interacting with us on Instagram, we have a bunch of opportunities in our stories usually, as well as rating and reviewing us. If you leave your name and your Hogwarts house in your review, you will get a shout out on here, as well as earn House Points for your house. So I'm super excited to see who is going to come out strongest for the next House Cup when we start Prisoner of Azkaban. And depending on how things go and how this podcast grows, we might do it after Prisoner of Azkaban or we might do it after Goblet of Fire. I will keep you guys updated on that. So without further ado, we're going to talk about Chamber of Secrets, the movie. This is actually one of my favorite Harry Potter movies, and I'm going to go through the details and talk about the adaptation and things they changed, as well as a few questions that popped up while I was rewatching the film. So at the beginning of this movie, we see the logo for Warner Brothers with the Harry Potter theme over it, and it goes into the title, which is just a staple of a Harry Potter movie. You'll see that in every film. And we start off in the Muggle world, where all of the houses are boring and look the same. And Harry is looking through the scrapbook that Hagrid made him, which I think is a really good callback to the first movie. And right after that, we get our owl image with Hedwig making noise. And Uncle Vernon yells at Harry, and Harry goes downstairs, and we find ourselves right before the dinner party is about to happen. And we get the detail that Harry hasn't received any letters from any of his friends. And here we have a conversation between Vernon and Harry where Uncle Vernon is saying that Harry should be grateful that they fed him and that they gave him the second bedroom purely out of the goodness of their hearts, when that's not entirely true. They gave Harry the bedroom out of fear, essentially, because they're scared of what Harry would do had they not given it to him. And also, grateful for what? Like, being abused, being reminded that you are totally unwanted in this household, there's nothing to be grateful to the Dursleys for. Like, giving him food, that's a basic human right. Shelter, also a basic human right. They're really not going out of their way in any way, shape, or form for Harry at all. So when Harry goes upstairs, we find Dobby jumping on the bed, which I think is super cute. And seeing Dobby come to life like this, I think, is so cool. And they really capture the conflict within Dobby of being here to warn Harry, but also being conflicted because he can't really do it because he's going against his family. And it's really great that in movie form, we can see the consequences of Dobby making noise in Harry's bedroom. So when we read Harry Potter, we are very close to Harry's point of view. So we really don't get to see other scenes from other people's point of view. However, because this is a movie and it's a visual medium, we get to see more things from other people's point of view. So we directly get to see Vernon in the middle of his joke, and we can hear Dobby from downstairs what he's doing in Harry's room, which causes Vernon to come upstairs. So it's nice to see that the consequences of what Dobby is doing. And so Dobby lets slip that he knows that Harry's friends haven't been writing to him, and we see a ton of letters that he's just been holding on to. And here was my question that I can't believe I didn't think to ask before. It occurred to me while I was watching the movie, when did Dobby decide to stop the letters? Because if Harry has been home all summer with no letters from any of his friends, that would imply that Dobby stopped his letters directly after his first year at Hogwarts ended. So why is he coming to Harry now and not earlier? Unless, now that I'm thinking about it, Dobby was hoping that Harry just wouldn't go back to school, but now that it's closer to going back to school time, he's really making sure that Harry doesn't go back. But I don't know, he wouldn't really know what Harry's decision would be until the day of going back to school anyway, right? So how did he know to stop the letters when he did? I'd love to just know the timeline of the information that Dobby had when he had it, when he decided to stop Harry's letters and basically intervene in this situation. And I think we get a really good acting moment from Daniel Radcliffe when he follows Dobby downstairs and he sees that Dobby is going to levitate the pudding and he sees what he's about to do. And we see in the book that moment of pure terror that Harry has when he realizes that Dobby's gonna get him into huge trouble. And you can see it in Daniel's eyes. You can see the fear sort of spark into them as soon as he realizes, oh my God, I might get murdered by my family. I don't know what they're gonna do. It's a really, really strong acting moment on Daniel's part. It's really subtle, but you can see the shift where he goes, oh, F. You can see it in his eyes. And we do miss out on the part where an owl flies in to warn Harry about not using magic outside of school. And we also get less of Harry's inner monologue, which maybe takes away from how sad and alone he feels at this part in the story, like we spoke about when we covered the early chapters of this book. But we also gain extra exposition in other moments outside of his point of view, like I was speaking about earlier. So that's so interesting about movies. We gain things and we lose things when movies are adapted from a source material. So for example, we lose out on the real context of Ron showing up. We don't learn that he's been worried about Harry because he hasn't been writing, but we do get this heroic sequence of them saving him and the moment where Harry has a few seconds of extra time because Vernon has put so many locks on Harry's door that Harry has like an extra few moments to sort of get most of the way out the window. So although we don't spend as much time with Harry's inner monologue about how lonely he's feeling, we do get to see other moments in a visual format that are a little bit more dynamic and a little bit more interesting in a visual format. For example, we get to see the Burrow for the first time in a real visual, not just in our imagination. We get to experience the magic of the house with Harry when he walks in, and you can see the sweater knitting itself and the dishes washing themselves. I wish I had that spell. And it's just a wonderful moment, and it's just a wonderful visual. We also lose the denoming section of of the Weasley's house, but I think we do get more of an insight into Weasley family dynamics in this film, even though we lose the information about how Harry feels like he's at home because everybody seems to like him here, and that's such a new concept for him. But we do get the physical comedy of Errol. So Errol knocking into the window, Errol basically like dive bombing the plates in the on the table in the Great Hall. We get that's very much a physical comedy beat that we is an added bonus in a visual film format. So they do change the way that flu powder works. In the book, the fire is already going and you step into it after you throw the flu powder in, and which is why Harry initially ends up in Nocturne Alley, because when he goes to say Diagon Alley, he immediately swallows like smoke and ash and then he's coughing. And in this version, he sort of says it with a weird accent, which I'm not entirely sure why he would do that, unless he's like super nervous and so it comes out very quickly and not how he would normally say it. I guess we could justify that. But it is sort of a bizarre change. But when Harry ends up in Borgin and Burke's, there is actually a scene here that you might not know about if you haven't watched the deleted scenes or the extended version of this film. There is a scene where we meet Draco and Lucius Malfoy in this store. So we do get an introduction a little bit earlier in the extended edition versus the theatrical edition. And also, Harry does have a little interaction with the storekeeper just before he leaves Borgin and Burke's. And I think those scenes, when added into the film, actually add another layer of tension and danger that Nocturne Alley presents, because it sort of compounds on top of Harry leaving the store and then immediately getting surrounded by wizards in the street who definitely do not have his best interest in mind. But thankfully, Hagrid saves the day, and we get a really cute callback to Hermione fixing his glasses like she does in the first film. And we get introduced to Gilderoy Lockhart, and I think Mrs. Weasley's reaction really captures, like, the fangirling aspect that's attached to him. We see it again when he throws his cape into the students at the dueling club where, you know, all the girls are like, oh my god, this is his cape and we can, like, touch it. And Mrs. Weasley fixes her hair while she's in line and insists that she's gonna get all the books signed for Harry. You know, it's funny, I think, and it really captures that fangirling aspect that follows Gilderoy Lockhart, because he's this big, handsome icon in the wizarding world at this point. And then after Lockhart takes the picture with Harry, the camera pans up and then we get our first real introduction to Draco Malfoy in the theatrical cut of this film. And of course, since we get our real introduction to Draco Malfoy, we also get our real introduction to Lucius Malfoy for the first time. And we see the incredible, incredible work of Jason Isaacs, who I think was just a perfect cast for Lucius Malfoy. And some of you may not know this because you're sort of newer to the fandom, but Jason Isaacs and Tom Felton, who plays Draco Malfoy, have this like incredible father-son thing that they've continued throughout the years. Like, they call each other, like, dad and son. I know I saw a video recently where they had FaceTimed together to talk about the pandemic. I'm pretty sure it was in conjunction with something with the Red Cross. And it was definitely like, hey, dad! It was really cute. So then we get actually two changes here. We don't get the brawl between Arthur and Lucius like we do in the book, but we do get an extra shot of the extra book that's in Ginny's cauldron. And I think this is what's so great about a visual medium, is that we can spend the time having a shot where, you know, Harry might not notice it and nobody else might have noticed it in the book, but since it's a film, we get a shot where all of a sudden there's two books in her cauldron, and then we know it's important, because films will take that extra second or two to have a specific shot in mind in order to call your attention to something that matters. So we all of a sudden see, oh wait, he had one book in his hand, but now there's two in her cauldron. That's really weird. I wonder what this is about. So later on, when Harry and Ron are in King's Cross and basically crash into the barrier between platforms 9 and 10, this is something I noticed. People notice them crash and gasp, but then the conductor, like, yells at them and nobody helps them up. Nobody wants to make sure they're okay. Like, Ron front flipped over his trolley, and no one is like, oh my God, boys, are you okay? It was astounding to me that these bystanders who see these two boys crash into a brick wall do not come over to help in any way, shape, or form. And so going along with this, we do lose out on the details of the car, but I think in this instance, it's actually okay because some details in movies, they're not going to explain because they're going to assume that the majority of their audience are people who have read the source material. So they won't necessarily spend the time, you know, explaining that, you know, the Weasleys have this car and Mr. Weasley charmed it. They don't need to spend that time because we've already read the book, most of us, and know that the car can fly without any explanation. We know why it can fly. No problem. But we do get the added dramatics of a scene in the car where Harry almost falls out of it because this is a movie and things need to be exciting. But this is something a little silly to analyze. So, and I can't tell if I half answered it or not. So when they lose control of the car, when they arrive at Hogwarts, there's a shot where Ron is stepping on all of the pedals. And there's three, which means that this car is a stick shift. And my first question was, I was wondering what this had to do with flying. Like, normally you'd change gears depending on how fast you're going, right? So my first question was, does this car have a specific gear just for flight mode? And later on in the film, when they're escaping Aragog, Ron does say the flying gear is jammed. So it seems that there is a gear shift to get the car up into the air, but I'm wondering if there are, like, do you shift into other gears while you're flying to control the speed if you wanted to go faster? Because Ron is literally just like stepping down on the pedals like quickly, not long enough like on the clutch to actually like shift gears. So does the clutch have like extra power when it comes to flying? Or is it specifically just to switch gears and then there's like, are there two sets of like gear shifts that one has to do if it's on the road and the other has to do if it's in the air? I have no idea. Please let me know because I've been thinking about this for the last like 2 days. Also, does it have anything to do with like the height? Do you need to like shift gears in order to get higher into the air? I don't know. Let me know. And we need to speak about Alan Rickman again, and I think I'm probably going to speak about him in every film that we watch because I miss him so much, but his body language as Snape when he's yelling at the boys and he like creeps around his desk toward them, but he's like hunched over and he has his like hands on his desk and he's sort of like creeping around like a spider. It's so good. His entire body language for this character is just incredible and I love to see it. And we actually get a shot of Percy and Penelope in this movie. There is absolutely no subplot at all about Percy being, like, weird. but they do acknowledge the fact that he has a girlfriend. This is something that you would need to know in order to catch it, having had read the books. Nearly Headless Nick passes by and he says, "Hello, Percy, Miss Clearwater." And then you're like, oh, okay, that's Percy and Penelope and they're together, and it's just, you know, open that I guess that they're dating in this movie. And I absolutely love the howler scene, and I love how visually they made the letter actually look like a mouth with like the ribbon, and the white paper looks like teeth, and then it rips itself up after it yells at him. It's just so cool the things they come up with in order to visually explain certain details from the source material. And going back to Lockhart for just a second, he's much less of a presence in this film. Like, he's not mansplaining to Professor Sprout how to patch up the Whomping Willow, and he's not pulling Harry aside to give him tips about fame or anything like that. But even though Lockhart is much less of a presence in this film, Kenneth Branagh just kills all of the scenes that he's in, and it just must have been so fun to be the costume designer for all of his costumes, because they're colors that you really don't see on anybody else, and they're, you know, clearly very fancy, and it just must have been so fun. And you know how I said in our last episode that Lockhart is essentially powerless against two 12-year-old wizards without his wand? Well, we also see that he's powerless without his wand against a room full of pixies. Like, he is not capable of wandless magic at all, whatsoever. And the scene where Draco calls Hermione a mudblood is actually weirdly less dramatic in this film than it is in the book. Like, in the film, you hear gasps, but no one really jumps at Draco or anything like that like they do in the book. There's less of, like, an instinctual reaction to hearing the term mudblood. It's a much more toned-down moment in the film, which I actually think you can argue takes away from the context of how bad of a term it is, because everyone's just like, oh, I can't believe he said that. But it in the book, they literally try to, like, fight Malfoy for calling Hermione this. And oddly enough, opposite from the book, Hermione seems a lot more hurt by this term in the movie than she does in the book. Like, she's crying in Hagrid's hut when she's explaining the situation and explaining what the term means. In the book, Ron is the one to explain what the term means. And it should be Ron, because he's part of this world, so he will have known about the term. While in the book, because Hermione is a muggle-born, she isn't used to hearing that word. She doesn't really know what it means. So it's a little bit more of a confusing moment for her, where she's like, obviously I could tell it was a bad term, but she doesn't really understand what it is, and so it doesn't affect her as much. While in the movie, she's actually upset about it and is the one to explain what the term means. The moment where Harry hears the voice of the basilisk while he's in Lockhart's office serving detention is so cool. And I love the shot where it's this low whispered rumble as you hear what it's saying, and you can hear it moving through the walls, like over the ceiling. And that scene ties into the scene where they discover Filch's cat. So there's no death day party, and you don't know it's Halloween. So Harry's alibi is actually covered by Lockhart, but we don't know where Ron and Hermione were. It's not said specifically that Ron was also in detention, and if he was, where was Hermione during this time? Because Hermione states that she and Ron were actually looking for him, but I would assume they would have known he was with Lockhart. And here's another thing, where when they discover the writing on the wall, Hermione says that it's written in blood. And I'm not sure, unless my memory is failing me, if this is actually ever confirmed, because we learn from Ginny's writing in the diary that she's covered in red paint in the book. But you can almost argue because she's questioning why she's covered in red paint. So we don't know if she thought it was paint and it was actually blood, or if it actually was paint on the wall. And in this scene, we get a great moment where we get the attitude from the teachers when Lockhart's trying to butt in, saying, oh, I would have known the counter curse that could have spared her. And McGonagall is just, like, not here for it at all. And speaking of McGonagall, this next set of scenes was actually in the trailer for this movie, and it's part of the reason why I have such fond memories of it, is because I remember seeing these scenes as part of the trailer before the movie came out. So we learn about the Chamber of Secrets from McGonagall, and I actually think it works really well. We get the backstory of Hogwarts, although there's no real fact versus myth argument in the film like we get with Binns, who doesn't even want to spend time on the subject. And having that explanation starts their conversation about who the heir of Slytherin might be. And we get the beginnings of the Polyjuice plan. And there's no need to trick Lockhart into getting permission from the restricted section. Hermione picks up the potion book on a regular shelf in the library. And can we just appreciate again how impressive it is that Hermione is able to brew this at 12 years old? I just think it's so impressive. Then we have the Quidditch game with the rogue bludger, and we learn from Hagrid that it must have been tampered with. Again, this is a prime example of film giving us a different perspective, because obviously in the book, Harry's starting to figure out that something's wrong with the bludger, but we stay with him the entire time while he's in the air. While in this movie, we can get a shot of Hagrid realizing that something's wrong with the bludger and actually vocalizing that something's wrong with it and someone has tampered with it. And in the film, Harry's mostly dealing with it himself. Like, the Weasleys don't come over to help him. And the bludger is, like, blasting through the structure of the stands, which seems unsafe, but nothing can interrupt Quidditch, so we just carry on with the game and it's fine. And here's another question that occurred to me while I was watching this film. How fast can a snitch go? Because I'm assuming that new brooms that are made to go faster and faster, right? So are snitches designed with a specific speed in mind? Do they have to be changed to match the upcoming models of brooms? So when I thought of this question, I actually reached out to Steven, aka Muggle in Khakis from Creating Magic podcast, and he was saying that there has to be a way within the charming process of creating snitches to set the speed. So theoretically, there should be a way to set the speed of a snitch as needed. And now I'm wondering, are all snitches like confiscated before the start of the professional Quidditch season to adjust to the brooms that everybody has so that they are faster than the brooms just enough so that they're still difficult to catch? Let us know your thoughts. I'm very interested to hear what you guys think about that. Also, another question. Why is Madame Pomfrey not at the Quidditch games? Like, she's like, oh, he should have been brought straight to me because after Harry breaks his arm, Lockhart tries to fix it and he screws up spectacularly. So you would think that during a sports game, like the school nurse would be like on the sidelines ready to jump in just in case someone gets hurt. I don't know. Seems kind of crazy that she's just in the castle and then they have to like carry whoever it is all the way into the castle up to the hospital wing rather than her just like be in the stands ready to go. I also really love the moment where they bring in a petrified Colin Creevy to the hospital wing when Harry is spending the night there, and McGonagall asks, what should I tell the staff? And Dumbledore says, the truth. And it's just so refreshing to have transparency with somebody in a leadership position to be like, no, we're not going to cover this up at all. We're not going to tell anybody any, like, fake stuff. We're going to tell the staff the truth about what's going on, that the Chamber of Secrets has indeed been opened again, and we need to do something about it. So in the Dueling Club, we actually get a line change, and it's the line about sending Harry to the hospital wing in a matchbox because Ron's wand is broken. So that line is actually about Neville and Justin Finch-Fletchley in the book. However, I think it works really well with being about Ron because Ron's wand is actually broken and has not been working properly this entire year. Also in this scene, Snape does not give Draco the idea for the snake spell like he does in the book. Draco just happens to do it himself. And again, going along with this idea that we don't really get Harry's internal monologue, when Harry goes to Dumbledore's office after he finds Nearly Headless Nick and Justin Finch-Fletchley petrified, and he asks the Sorting Hat if he put him in the right house. First, I like that Harry doesn't have to put it on in order to talk to it, but it's also a moment where we don't fully understand why Harry is asking that question because we're not getting that internal struggle and that guilt that Harry feels about, A, everybody now thinks that he's the heir of Slytherin, but he also recognizes that he was almost put into Slytherin. So we don't fully understand the motivation behind that question because we don't get that internal monologue of his insecurity about the house situation. And I love, love, love Dumbledore in this scene. And I need to take the opportunity to speak on this because I have not gotten it out of my system yet. For context, I recently watched a Prisoner of Azkaban watch along. And some of the people on the panel were stating that clearly Michael Gambon, who plays Dumbledore in the next film Onward, is a much better Dumbledore and how Richard Harris couldn't have possibly done what he does in the following films. And I just need to take a moment to call this out because I wasn't able to do it at the time of watching the watch along, which really frustrated me. But this is just false. Look, okay, so I'm going to say this. Everyone's entitled to their own opinion and everyone's allowed to have their favorite Dumbledore. That's fine. I think the way these people said that Michael Gambon was clearly the better Dumbledore in a way, they said it in a way that made it sound as though like all Harry Potter fans thought this, and that's just not true. Because I think going out of the way to say that Gambon was clearly 100% the better choice as Dumbledore is kind of an incredible statement. What I love about Richard Harris as Dumbledore is what you can see in this moment in the film. He commands respect without raising his voice. His voice is calm and it's gentle, and yet he commands his power. We see that in the first film as well, where he is soft-spoken until he needs to yell when the troll is in the castle to get the attention of all of the students. And so when he asks Harry in this moment, "Is there anything you wish to tell me?" you can get the glimpse of the version of Dumbledore that we've seen in the two books we have read so far, where he knows more about what's going on than people think he does. And he can see right through people, like Harry says to Tom Riddle at the end of this movie and this book. I just love that calm, gentle presence that's also very powerful. And I think that is so Dumbledore, and I just love that version that Richard Harris brings to these first two films. That's all I'm going to say on the subject. Let's move on. So there actually isn't the same hesitation that Harry and Ron have about the Polyjuice plan that they do in the book, where Hermione sort of needs to call them out and sort of guilt trip them into following through with this plan. And with the Polyjuice plan, I have to say that it's always super impressive to see actors needing to act like other actors acting like them. So I really give a lot of credit to the actors who play Crabbe and Goyle in these scenes. I think they did a really great job. And speaking of everybody's acting ability, I've heard that when Draco stumbles upon them in the corridor and he goes, "Why are you wearing glasses?" I've heard that that exchange was actually improvised by Tom Felton, which is kind of amazing. And we also have a later line at the end of this film, which I'll talk about, from Daniel Radcliffe when he's talking to Lucius Malfoy. And if it's true that both of those lines were improvised, that's incredible. Although I do wish we saw more of the Slytherin common room in these scenes, because it looks beautiful. And I would love to just explore the Slytherin common room, because everything I've heard about it from the book and then, you know, from what we see from the set design in this film, it just looks gorgeous, like a totally awesome, cozy, gorgeous place to be. Okay, so side note, sort of a fun fact, I guess, but something that I was thinking about from an acting point of view. So the woman who plays Moaning Myrtle, her name is Shirley Henderson, and you might also have seen her in Bridget Jones's Diary. So she was, like, much older than the rest of these actors when she was playing Moaning Myrtle. And I truly think that someone must have, like, pulled her in or, like, called her to audition for this film specifically, because something tells me, like, normally with, like, acting roles, things will go out that'll apply to the role that they're casting. So it'll be like someone between the ages of 16 to 17 or 18 plus, but can look younger with brown hair and, you know, this height maybe. Something tells me that, like, she probably, like, wouldn't have applied with, like, the normal breakdown had it gone in a normal breakdown. Like, I truly, like, this is just a theory, but I truly think someone must have, like, seen her work and been like, her voice is perfect. She still looks young. Let's bring her in for this role. Because, like, she probably would not, like, if they had already been, like, looking for someone who was, like, a teenager like the rest of these kids were, which they would have probably done if someone didn't have her in mind. Because they're working with kids on these films all the time. Like, sometimes they hire 18 plus who look younger because it's easier contractually, because children can only work for a certain amount of hours on set. So, I don't know. Maybe it's a weird theory, but I truly think that someone, like, knew of her work and, like, brought her on for this role. I'll have to, like, do some digging about that. So when we actually get to see the diary physically, I love the visual of the light coming out of the book and overtaking Harry and, like, sucking him into the memory that way. And the way they structured this memory is, like, super cool. And it occurs to me in this moment that this is the first Slytherin that Harry has actually trusted thus far in our story, and he does so right away. So that's super interesting. The fact that Harry wasn't suspicious of this guy whatsoever, even though he was in Slytherin. He trusts his word and he trusts his memory right off the bat. Now, speaking of this, though, in the film, when they are in the courtyard, Ron says, "I don't even know this Tom Riddle. Sounds like a dirty, rotten snitch to me." Because they do away with the fact that Ron recognizes the name on the diary when he was serving detention cleaning trophies. However, there is a deleted scene where Ron does put together the pieces and remembers seeing the name on the trophy. So that's either an inconsistency or Ron is speaking about his personality in general. Like, they don't know him. Like, they don't know who he is specifically personality-wise. Not that he doesn't know who he is at all in general. Also, Hermione doesn't have that moment of like, oh my god, I think I understand what's going on, before she heads to the library, before she gets petrified. So there's like no lead up to the fact that she was attacked. We just know she happened to be in the library doing whatever she was doing because she's Hermione. And surprise, surprise, she spends time in the library. We only find out later that she was on the case when they discover the page within her hand. And of course, you know, Ron and Harry didn't know exactly what she was up to in the book, but we do have that moment where we sort of knew that she was going to the library before the Quidditch game and sort of has this epiphany moment that she does not explain to the boys before she runs off. Okay, now, so with Hagrid's crossbow, who was he expecting and who was he planning to shoot? I'm just wondering, like, who was he planning to shoot? Like, who did he expect to be at his door that he was going to shoot? I'm so curious. In this scene, we meet the minister, but without his lime green bowler hat, which kills me because I wanted to see it so bad. And we have Dumbledore and Lucius Malfoy, and Dumbledore again knowing more than he lets on. He knows that Harry and Ron are under the cloak right there. He looks them right in the eye. And I found it interesting in this scene that Fudge comes alone to take Hagrid to Azkaban. Like, Hagrid could easily overpower him if he needed to. And Fudge just doesn't bring any extra security, even though he is the Minister of Magic. And now I'm wondering, like, why is the Minister of Magic coming to arrest Hagrid? Like, there's no team for that? I don't know. And one of my favorite scenes in this film is after they find the page in Hermione's hand about the basilisk. I love the entire process of them putting the pieces together. And I love the shot where Harry looks at the window and figures everything out about how people didn't look it directly in the eye because he's looking at his reflection. Oh my god, I think it's so cool and I think it's such a cool shot, and I just love how they're like stopping and moving and then stopping again while they're like reading this page and all of the pieces are falling into place. I thought it was really well choreographed and just like such a cool moment to show how Harry put the pieces together as to why people weren't killed and they're just petrified. And I would have loved to be a fly on the wall for all of the professors' conversations this year and to sort of see how their conversations changed from, oh, it's a prank, it's a fluke, to like, oh my god, what are we gonna do, where is this chamber? And I'm very much convinced that these teachers must have spent most of this year trying to find the chamber again. I know we have been told, both in the book and by McGonagall in the film, that no chamber has been found, but you cannot tell me that they have not looked for it again when all of this started to occur once more. One thing that made me laugh was when Harry and Ron are running to visit Lockhart in order to tell him the information that they know about what's in the Chamber of Secrets, Harry yells, "Lockhart may be useless," when he's in the Defense Against the Dark Arts classroom, like, not 15 feet away from the door to the office. Like, probably Lockhart can hear you. Like, I would have understood if he was, like, yelling that in the corridor outside the classroom. But, like, once you're in the classroom, you probably shouldn't be, like, bad-mouthing the teacher and you're about to, like, try to help. And then, so, okay, as I listened to Moaning Myrtle's, like, death story again, I'm wondering what Riddle would have done had, like, Hagrid not been harboring a creature because it gave him a very good way to get his way, you know, having opened the Chamber of Secrets, but he's able to keep Hogwarts open because he puts the blame on somebody else. So I'm wondering, like, if Hagrid hadn't gone to school at the same time Tom Riddle did, or if he wasn't, you know, Hagrid and, like, harboring an Acromantula in secret, like, what would Riddle have expected to do? And I'm just wondering what his overall plan was. Like, if he was planning to kill all the Muggleborns in the school to, like, finish Salazar Slytherin's work, did he really expect the school to stay open and just be like, did he expect the staff to just be like, okay, guess we're just teaching purebloods now? Like, I don't think that's what would have happened. Like, at least not under the leadership of, like, Headmaster Dibbit, probably not. And, like, I think Dumbledore definitely would have been like, no, let's close the school, like, 100%. I'm very curious to know what his plan was. I also love the design of the door to the Chamber of Secrets, where it's, like, all of the snakes, and then one snake goes around, and, like, all of them have to move out of the way. I think it's super cool. When you see it at the studio tour, it's, like, gigantic and it's awesome and I love it. I think that whole design is super cool. I love the entire design of the chamber itself as well, and I like how they made the decision to just have the structure of Slytherin's face and not like a full structure of his body. I think it worked really well with the aesthetic of the chamber that they came up with. And if you look very closely at the moment where Tom Riddle takes Harry's wand, it's kind of generic looking. So Harry's wand does have a specific design for the films, and this must have been just before they had, like, figured it out, because when you buy, like, the replica wands that they have, like, Harry's has a specific look to it. But the one that, like, Tom Riddle picks up is just sort of, like, it's generic. It does not look like what they decided on Harry's wand design would be, I guess, in later films. And the acting of the guy who plays Tom Riddle is so good. I love actors that can just, like, speak without moving the rest of their face, because, like, Voldemort seems like someone who doesn't need to, like, move his hands around a lot, because his power and his words can carry, like, his power for him, unlike me, who struggles to, like, not move my hands and make noise when I'm recording a podcast. But I think there's more power when somebody in a film can just speak without all of this extraneous movement or detail or anything like that. And I think he captures that super well, because he gets the point across of his power while being, like, subtle at the same time, because he's not moving all over the place. They can just have a shot of him, like, speaking, and the way he speaks is enough to carry the scene in a really powerful way. So there's a few changes at the end of this movie from the book, and one of the huge changes that they make is that in the book, the basilisk can smell Harry after it's blinded. In the movie, it can hear him. And I think that hearing Harry actually works better visually. Like, the moment that Harry takes, like, those two little steps and the snake immediately hones in on him is, like, this incredible and terrifying moment. And it works out well in the end of this film because it gives Harry a little bit more of a strategic win. So if the basilisk can just smell him, it doesn't matter what Harry does, because you can't really get rid of your smell, right? But if it's sound, Harry can control that a little bit. Although it's hard, because, like, how do you run away from a basilisk without making any noise, right? So that's what builds the tension and the danger in the scene, is that Harry has control over how much he moves, but he also needs to figure out a way to move silently or move fast enough out of the way of the basilisk so then he can, like, stop and, like, not make noise, and then he, like, uses the rock to distract it, essentially. I think this is a change that actually works better in this circumstance than it would had they kept it in the book. We also see the sword appear in the hat, but Harry doesn't have to put the hat on in order to get it. And because this is a movie and things need to be exciting, Harry climbs the statue of Slytherin in order to get a better angle at killing the basilisk. And I love this scene again because it was in the trailer. I love, like, I remember being like, oh my God, when Harry sort of falls off the head of the statue and you just see the sword start to fall off the edge. Oh my God, so exciting. It still sticks out in my brain as part of the trailer. And it's just a very special moment that sticks out to me. We also lose the moment where Riddle forgets about the phoenix. Fox actually doesn't come to heal Harry until after he stabbed the diary. And I love the visual that matches it when he stabs the diary and the ink just like splurts everywhere. I think that really matches the description in the book really well. And seeing Riddle sort of fall apart and he's made of that same light that pulled Harry into the diary earlier in the film, I thought that was a really cool visual to see. But speaking of this change where Fox doesn't heal Harry until after he stabs the diary. So in the book, Fox comes over, starts to heal Harry. Riddle's like, oh my God, I forgot. And then Fox sort of like brings the diary like to Harry. And that's where Harry gets the idea to stab it, right? But having Fox do it afterward, because there's a little bit of time between Harry getting rid of Tom Riddle and being healed by the Phoenix. And I think this moment is super strong because Harry thinks he's going to die in this moment, right? He thinks that there's no way to be healed. He was, you know, stabbed by a basilisk fang. But he is giving Ginny instructions as to how to get out and to find Ron. He's still saving her in what he thinks are his last moments. And that just shows so much about Harry's character. That he is like, you need to get yourself out of here. You know, if you go this way, you're gonna find Ron and it's gonna be okay. In his last moments, he's still caring about somebody else above himself because he did what he needed to do. He came down to the chamber to save Ginny and ends up defeating Voldemort yet again. So at the end in Dumbledore's office, we do get a moment where Harry voices his concerns about the similarities that he's recognized between him and Voldemort. And this is, again, sort of the first glimpse that we see at his internal struggle that Harry has been dealing with all book. And we get the explanation of why there are similarities between the two, but also the detail as to why Harry is a Gryffindor. You know, because he asked it to and he pulled this sword out of the hat, which Dumbledore says takes a true Gryffindor to pull that out of the hat. So we get a little bit more of a glimpse into that internal struggle that he's been dealing with. I guess you could say behind the scenes in this film because we don't get a lot of details about it, but we know it's there having read the book. So the other improvised line is when Harry says, "Don't worry, I will be." When Lucius Malfoy says, "Well, let us hope that Harry Potter will always be around to save the day." And apparently that was also an improvised line, which is incredible. And this scene with Lucius Malfoy, the lighting of this scene is so good. Because if you see, Lucius Malfoy is only lit, like, over his eyes and, like, his nose. And then everything else is in shadow. And he sort of, like, steps into that light. You know, he hits the mark and like has that sort of rectangle over his face of light. And it just works so well for his character. It sort of shows like the darkness of his character. And it's such, it makes him much more menacing in this moment. And it's very like old school film style. And I loved seeing it. And it really sort of separates him from the other two characters that are in this office. From Harry and Dumbledore. And so they also do change the way that Harry frees Dobby, and I'm not sure that one way is better than the other. I think they probably just had Harry put it in between the pages of the diary because it was probably easier to film, especially given like the diary size. Like, I have no idea. Like, I don't know how big the the diary was in the book, but like, you sort of need like a big sock to cover a book like that. I don't know. So they have instead Lucius Malfoy hand over the diary, and then Harry tells Dobby to open it, and the sock is there, and that's how Dobby gets freed. And the end of this film, without fail, has me in tears. When Hagrid comes back, and Harry has that line of, there's no Hogwarts without you, Hagrid, and everybody starts clapping, it kills me. It literally, like, I cannot watch the ending of Chamber of Secrets and watch that part specifically without crying. It's just so sweet. I don't know. Please tell me I'm not the only one who cries at the end of this movie. So that is our discussion on Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets, the movie. A lot of people don't really like this movie, and I'm not sure I completely understand that. I know it's very hard to pick a favorite Harry Potter movie, but I do think that this one is actually one of the better adaptations of the book. I think that the key to a good adaptation is keeping the overall spirit of the story alive and hitting all of the correct plot points in between the changes that you make, because you're always going to have to make changes from the source material. So as long as the overall spirit of the story and like the overarching plot is the same, I think you end up with a pretty good adaptation. And I think that this movie hits all of those points. I might be biased because I have like super nostalgic memories of this film, because this is the first film that I can remember clearly the trailer of. I really don't remember the trailers for the other movies. This is also the first film that I remember seeing in theaters. I do not remember watching Sorcerer's Stone for the first time. I have no memory of that. So I definitely have like a connection with this film for sure. But let me know what you guys think of this movie. Is it your favorite? Is it not your favorite? Why? What's your favorite part? What has been your favorite part about Chamber of Secrets so far? Let me know either on Instagram or on Twitter at firstyearspod, or you can always email us at firstyearspodcast@gmail.com. This has been an incredible series of episodes on Chamber of Secrets, and I am so excited to dive into Prisoner of Azkaban with you guys. I mapped out all of our episodes for Prisoner of Azkaban. We are going to be talking about Prisoner of Azkaban until November, and I'm so pumped. There is so much in that book to talk about, and I hope that you guys join me on the next book, and we will hop back on the Hogwarts Express to go over Prisoner of Azkaban next episode. So get reading on that. You'll need to read chapters 1-4 of Prisoner of Azkaban for our first episode. Congratulations again to Hufflepuff for winning the first ever First Year's House Cup tournament, and I will see you guys next time. First Year's is a production of Matchbook. It's produced by Quinn Parker and myself, Sarah Jones-Dittmeyer. All sources for our episodes can be found in our show notes or on our website at authorsarahjonesdittmeyer.info/firstyearspodcast. That's Sarah with an H, and Dittmeyer is spelled Dittmeyer. Special thanks goes to, of course, J.K. Rowling, who's the author of our main source, Harry Potter.